Our time is up for today. I hope you will join me next time when we continue with I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. This has been Bridget Willis for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the coronavirus update, followed by USA Today at 2.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 66 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Tuesday, February 2nd, 2021, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael, and coming up in our program today, we'll read articles that include Pfizer says it expects to deliver 200 million COVID-19 vaccine doses to the U.S. by the end of May. White House COVID response team expected to announce direct vaccine shipments to pharmacies today. More than 1 in 5 U.S. COVID-19 deaths were reported in January. Coronavirus strain in U.K. picks up mutation that could impact vaccines, experts say. Americans are more concerned about COVID-19 variants than opening schools, Axios Ipsos poll says. And then we have a couple of articles that are at odds with each other. People previously infected with COVID-19 may only need one vaccine dose, study suggests. But Dr. Fauci warns against administering only the first dose of COVID-19 vaccines. States have mixed response to White House's guidance on not holding back vaccine doses. Animals unlikely to spread COVID-19 to humans, but precautions can help keep us safe, says CDC. Tokyo Olympics will go ahead despite pandemic, Games Chief says. Analysis, the pandemic is still dwarfing the size of Washington's efforts to fight it. First, we'll look at the numbers. Ector County numbers from the Texas Department of Health and Human Services have not changed since yesterday. Confirmed cases, 6,976. Probable cases, 6,551. Fatalities, 295. Active cases, 1,430, estimated. Estimated recovered, 11,802. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, we have Midland County's numbers. Midland Health reported Monday that the positivity rate in Midland is down to the lowest level going back to September. The hospital showed that 12.2% of those tested at Midland Health test centers were COVID positive. That was the lowest rate going back to the week of September 26th, when it was 11.5%. Midland Health also reported 116 positive cases, which were the fewest going back to October 10th, when it was 96. The numbers showed that the trend COVID's lessening impact in the community. Midland Health is reporting 4 straight weeks of positivity declines from 29.7% to 12.2%. COVID's impact on the hospital also is notable, as Midland Health reported that 14% of the total rooms at Midland Memorial Hospital are being used on COVID patients. Again, the lowest percentage since early October. Also, the 30 active COVID patients, 17 in the critical care unit, and 13 on the COVID floor, represent rare territory as of late. Overall, 67% of 284 total inpatient rooms are occupied. The 7-day average is 76%. The region, which includes Midland and Odessa, also appears to be in good shape, according to the Department of State Health Services. As of Saturday, the percentage of patients that were positive for COVID at regional hospitals had dropped to 7.55%. That's the third lowest rate for any of the 23 regions in the state. The Department of State Health and Human Services percentage is important because if that percentage is at or above 15.1% for 7 straight days, additional restrictions are put into place. The last time such restrictions were in place in Midland was mid-December. The Midland Health Department showed Monday that the number of confirmed COVID cases involving Midland County residents actually increased from 415 to 461 week over week. And the Texas Tribune with the state numbers. COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations decreasing after record highs in January. Actually, the first number that we have is an increase. Average new cases increased by 907 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. This is the first time in many days that that has shown an increase. On February 1st, 11,885 new confirmed cases and 2,248 new probable cases were reported. However, hospitalizations decreased by 1,711 patients compared with a week ago. As of February 1st, 11,074 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. New deaths also decreased. Average new deaths decreased by 24 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On February 1st, 48 new deaths were reported. For the U.S., the United States reported 130,759 new COVID infections and 1,881 virus-related deaths on Monday, according to a tally by Johns Hopkins University. The national totals now stand at 26,317,623 confirmed cases and 443,355 fatalities since the pandemic began. At least 49,936,450 vaccine doses have been distributed, and at least 32,222,402 shots administered, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, coronavirus briefs. In its first publicly available test results, Russia's already widely distributed vaccine, Sputnik V, was shown to be 91.6% effective against coronavirus in phase 3 trials, according to peer-reviewed findings published in The Lancet, a British medical journal. The findings make Sputnik only the third vaccine to have an efficacy of over 90%, after a vaccine from U.S. pharmaceutical giant Pfizer, produced with German biotech firm BioNTech, and one from the U.S. biotech firm Moderna. President Biden met with 10 moderate Republican senators proposing a much smaller coronavirus relief bill than the one the president wants. No deal was reached. The rate of new infections is declining in the United States after rapid increases over the holiday season. The 7-day average of new cases was down 13%. Deaths, however, increased by 2%, following record hospitalizations, according to data tracked by the Washington Post. Montgomery County, Maryland health officials have confirmed 2 cases of the variant found in South Africa. Captain Sir Tom Moore, the 100-year-old veteran who raised almost $45 million for Britain's National Health Service by repeatedly walking the length of his garden during the nationwide lockdown last year, has died, his family announced Tuesday. Data on race and ethnicity was not collected for nearly half of the people receiving vaccines for the first month they were available, threatening efforts to ensure an equitable response to the pandemic. New York City has identified 13 cases of the UK COVID-19 variant, health officials says. White House says states will be fully repaid for PPE and National Guard response to COVID-19. And now here are our articles for today. Pfizer says it expects to deliver 200 million COVID-19 vaccine doses to the U.S. by the end of May. From CNN's Amanda Seely. Pfizer said it expects to deliver 200 million doses of its COVID-19 vaccine to the United States by the end of May, according to slides published for its fourth quarter 2020 earnings teleconference on Tuesday. The company was originally slated to deliver the 200 million doses by July 31st, but Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla said last week he expected the company's production to be ahead of schedule by 2 months. In the U.S., we had promised to provide 100 million doses by the end of the first quarter, and we will be able to provide 120 right now, Bourla said last week. The same is with the second quarter. We were planning to provide them all the way to 200 million doses by the end of the second quarter, actually beginning of the third. Right now, we will be able to provide the 200 million doses 2 months earlier. The Biden administration has also announced it will be purchasing an additional 100 million doses from the company. As of January 31st, Pfizer says it has supplied 20 million doses to the United States. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, 17,364,398 doses of the Pfizer vaccine have been administered. White House COVID response team expected to announce direct vaccine shipments to pharmacies today. From CNN's Kevin Liptak. The Biden administration is set to announce it will soon begin direct shipments of coronavirus vaccines to retail pharmacies, according to an official familiar with the matter, expanding points of access for Americans to receive shots. The effort is part of the administration's attempt to speed up vaccinations by making them available in more locations. It wasn't clear yet how many doses of the vaccine would be made available directly to pharmacies right away. Administration officials were planning to brief representatives from major pharmacy chains on Tuesday before announcing the plan publicly. The White House COVID response coordinator, Jeffrey Zients, has a scheduled media briefing around noon, though the announcement on direct distribution to pharmacies could potentially come later. More than 1 in 5 U.S. COVID-19 deaths were reported in January, from CNN's Deidre McPhillips. More than 443,000 people in the United States have died of COVID-19 since the pandemic began about a year ago. About 22% of those deaths, more than 95,000, were reported in January, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. December was the second deadliest month, with more than 77,000 reported deaths, followed by April, with nearly 61,000 reported deaths. More than half of all COVID-19 deaths were reported in those 3 months, January 2021, December 2020, and April 2020. The 7-day average of new cases has dropped nearly every day since reaching a peak on January 8th, but reported deaths remain high. In January, there were more than 3,000 deaths reported each day on average. Coronavirus strain in UK picks up mutation that could impact vaccines, experts say. From CNN's Michael Nettleman and Nina Avramova. A mutation that could allow COVID-19 to escape antibody protection has now been found in samples of a rapidly spreading strain in the UK, according to a report by Public Health England on Monday. The mutation called E484K was already part of the genetic signature of variants linked to South Africa and Brazil. According to the PHE report, the mutation has also been newly detected in at least 11 samples of the UK's B117 strain. It also appears some of these samples may have acquired this mutation independently instead of spreading from a single case. This could mean a variant already known to be more transmissible also risks becoming somewhat resistant to the immune protection offered by vaccines, or more likely to cause reinfection among people who were previously infected, experts say. This doesn't appear to be great news for vaccine efficacy, said Joseph Falver, associate research scientist in epidemiology at the Yale School of Public Health. He added that the new finding is also something to keep monitoring in the U.S., where efforts to look for variants through genetic sequencing have lagged behind the U.K. The fact that we've only seen this in the U.K. may be a result of their robust genomic surveillance program, Fowler said. Experts say it's too early to predict whether this development will greatly impact the trajectory of COVID-19 in the U.K. and around the world. Previous studies suggest that E484K may be the key culprit behind why certain vaccines appear less effective in South Africa. Lab research has also shown that antibodies appear less able to bind and neutralize spike proteins arising from the mutation. Novavax recently announced its vaccine was 89% effective in its Phase 3 UK trial, but only appeared 60% effective in a separate Phase 2B study conducted in South Africa. Similarly, in Johnson & Johnson's Phase 3 trial, efficacy differed by country, 72% in the U.S. versus 57% in South Africa. In both trials, 90 to 95% of cases in South Africa were linked to the B1351 variant, which contains the E484K mutation. Paul Bienaz, a virologist at Rockefeller University, noted that the E484K mutation has appeared sporadically in multiple samples for months, but until recently, it didn't appear to offer the virus an advantage in populations with no pre-existing immunity. But it's a different story in places like South Africa, where many people had been previously infected. On Monday, Dr. Anthony Fauci noted a very high rate of reinfection to the point where previous infection does not seem to protect you, citing the work of colleagues in South Africa. The B117 strain, first spotted in the UK, has now been found in at least 70 countries worldwide, including about 470 known cases in the U.S., according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Experts say that aggressive testing, adhering to COVID-19 guidelines, and rapidly rolling out vaccines are more important than ever in light of these spreading variants. We need to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as we possibly can, Fauci previously said. Even though there is a diminished protection against the variants, there's enough protection to prevent you from getting serious disease, including hospitalization and deaths. Americans are more concerned about COVID-19 variants than opening schools, Axios Ipsos poll finds, from CNN's Ashley Ahn. Americans are concerned about the new COVID-19 variants and worrying less about sending children back to school, according to an Axios Ipsos poll published Tuesday. The latest poll found 83% of people sampled reported that they are at least somewhat concerned new strains may be more contagious, while about 33% of them said they are extremely concerned. Over half of Americans are extremely or very concerned about new strains. The poll reports that Americans across age, race, and party share this concern. Only 26% of people polled expect life to return to pre-COVID normal by July, and 30% anticipate it will take more than a year, and 8% said never. Reflecting a similar timeline, 21%, 25%, and 18% of Americans expect the COVID-19 vaccine to be available in the next 3, 6, or more than 6 months, respectively. Compared to the late August Axios Ipsos poll, reporting that 74% of Americans had some level of concern about schools reopening, the figure has since dropped to 59%, with only one-third feeling extremely or very concerned, down from half. The poll, which gathered data from 1,038 U.S. adults from January 29th to February 1st, suggests that many Americans across partisan lines are wary of the new strains, yet concerns that the new strains may be more transmissible or dangerous are also bipartisan, with 95%, 82%, and 71% of Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, respectively, concerned about new strains. Only 15% of Americans who skew older and Democratic said they are wearing two masks some or all of the time in public as an extra layer of protection. People previously infected with COVID-19 may only need one vaccine dose, study suggests, from CNN's Amanda Seely and Michael Nettleman. After getting just one shot of a COVID-19 vaccine, people who were previously infected show antibody levels equal to or above those of people who had gotten both doses but had never been infected, according to a study published Monday. Those with previous infections also appeared to have more generalized side effects after the first dose, such as fatigue, fever, and muscle pain, similar to what other participants might be expected to have after a second dose of an mRNA vaccine, the researchers wrote. The authors of this preprint study, which has not been peer-reviewed, argued that changing policy to give these individuals only one dose would spare them from unnecessary pain and free up many urgently needed vaccine doses. How the research was conducted. The study involved 109 vaccine recipients, 41 of whom were previously infected with the virus. The study does not specify which vaccine participants received or how severe their illness was when they were infected with the virus.
People who had not been infected before showed a relatively low antibody response in the first 9 to 12 days after vaccination, researchers said. People with previous infections quickly developed high antibody titers within days, which were measured to be 10 to 20 times higher at times. The study did not demonstrate whether that resulted in a greater level of protection from getting infected, and follow-up studies are ongoing. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that people should get vaccinated even if they had COVID-19, since it's yet unclear how long antibody protection lasts. Dr. Fauci warns against administering only the first dose of COVID-19 vaccines, from CNN Health's Ashley Ahn. Dr. Anthony Fauci on Tuesday warned against administering just the first dose of COVID-19 vaccines in order to inoculate as many people as possible. The danger is that the efficacy following a single dose is not as great as after the second dose, and if you have some optimum efficacy, you could, in fact, paradoxically, be selecting for more mutations, Fauci said during a Washington Post live event. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, told NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday that as many people as possible over the age of 65 should be given their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine ahead of a possible surge in cases due to more transmissible variants. This strategy could delay second doses and would go against the optimum approach to Pfizer and Moderna vaccinations. Fauci said, while the idea isn't completely outlandish, the solution to a limited supply of doses and new coronavirus variants is not to administer single doses, but to ramp up the availability of vaccine doses, not only of Moderna and Pfizer, but also new candidates such as Johnson & Johnson, Novavax, and Oxford AstraZeneca, among others. The best way to prevent the evolution of mutations is to suppress the replication of the virus in the community, which means that we need to vaccinate as many people as quickly as we possibly can do it, as efficiently as we possibly can, Fauci said. States have mixed response to White House's guidance on not holding back vaccine doses, from CNN's Kristen Holmes. A day after the White House Coronavirus Task Force cautioned providers not to hold back first doses of COVID-19 vaccine for later use as potential second doses, some states and providers remain hesitant to comply, worried about future supply of when second doses come due. One state official told CNN that the state is telling providers not to use all their doses now and instead hold back for a second dose use. An official in another state said it is encouraging providers to follow White House guidance, but is getting pushback from providers over supply concerns. It is ultimately up to the states how they use their allocations of vaccine. Animals unlikely to spread COVID-19 to humans, but precautions can help keep us safe, says CDC. From CNN's Lauren Mascarenhas. There's no evidence that animals are playing a significant role in the spread of coronavirus to humans, but precautions can help keep people and their pets safe, U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention officials said Monday. Based on limited information available to date, the risk of animals, including pets, spreading COVID-19 to people is considered to be low, CDC official Dr. Casey Barton Befresh said during a briefing Monday. Evidence suggests that COVID-19 likely originated in animals before becoming widespread among humans. As of the middle of January, we're aware of 187 animals from 22 countries with a confirmed SARS-CoV-2 infection, Beharvish said, noting those numbers do not include mink on mink farms. She added that no animal deaths have yet been linked to the virus. The CDC is closely tracking research on coronavirus infections in animals and has categorized some animals based off their risk of infection. Animals that are highly susceptible to the virus include cats, hamsters, non-human primates, rabbits, mink, and deer, Beharvish said. Tokyo Olympics will go ahead despite pandemic, Games Chief says, from CNN's Chi Kobayashi. The pandemic-delayed Tokyo 2020 Olympics will be held this year no matter how the COVID situation will be, Games originating committee president Yoshiro Mori said Tuesday. Speaking in a news conference on preparations for the Games, Mori said, "We will make sure the Games will be held no matter how the COVID situation will be. We go beyond the discussion of whether we hold the Games or not hold. We are to come up with new Olympics." Some context. After the COVID-19 pandemic forced organizers to delay the Summer Olympics last year, the Games are now set to begin on July 23rd. But major questions remain as to how Japan plans to pull off what could prove to be the most complex sporting event ever held. In between surging cases and a global scramble for vaccines, organizers last month denied reports the Games would be canceled altogether. Analysis. The pandemic is still dwarfing the size of Washington's efforts to fight it. Analysis from CNN's Stephen Collinson. The long war against COVID-19, even more daunting in the dispiriting months of winter, is now posing a fundamental question over whether the United States has the political, economic, and national will to prevail before the disaster gets much worse. A race against time to vaccinate sufficient Americans before mutant versions of the virus cause a new wave of sickness and death is turning into a critical stress test for a mass immunization effort off to a difficult start. And there is disconnect in Washington over the scale of the crisis, with Democrats demanding a go-big economic rescue plan and the few Republicans who back action envisioning a much more modest approach. It remains unclear whether vaccine and testing efforts, attempts to alleviate harrowing economic suffering, and the level of buy-in from the American people themselves are sufficient for the challenges that lie ahead. The fate of the country and of Biden's presidency depends to a considerable extent on his capacity to steel Americans for the next stage of the battle and his ability to maintain national morale. But the president is leading a country beaten down by months of social distancing, family isolation, and economic pain, left as divided as it has been since the Civil War by Donald Trump's tumultuous exit. And that is your coronavirus update for this Tuesday, February 2nd, 2021, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael, and coming up next, we will be bringing you the program Enabled. Following that at 2, it's USA Today with National News. And at 3, we'll bring you our local news broadcast. Here are some of the newspaper articles our volunteers are reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Midland Memorial Hospital says positivity rate down to lowest level since September. Local taxing entities' debt remains above $800 million. Small Bites, Sumo Sushi and Hibachi opens. Shrimp Fest postponed. And from today's Odessa American, renowned slam poet and professor to speak. Shrimp Fest, going virtual in a Shrimp Fest shift. Fundraiser goes online amidst coronavirus. Those are some of the articles that we'll be reading this afternoon at 3. And at 6, more news from the Wall Street Journal. Thank you very much for letting us spend this time with you today. Be safe and have a great rest of your day.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 66 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-70s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Thank you for listening to Enabled this week. I'll start by reading you some information from the Salt Lake City Tribune, published just a couple weeks ago. The article starts by saying Utah is home to mountain air, deserts, national parks, the Great Salt Lake, the greatest snow on earth, and evil spirits and an alien spacecraft. Well, maybe. At least according to a new series airing on the Discovery Channel. It's what they call a reality TV show. It's called Mystery at Blind Frog Ranch, and it follows Texan Dwayne Ollinger, his son Chad Ollinger, and a small team looking for gold and buried treasure in Uinta County in Utah. They battle the elements in dangerous situations and possibly some paranormal elements in an area that the elder Mr. Ollinger tells viewers the area just don't feel right. In 2009, Dwayne Ollinger first saw the region's caverns. In 2018, he bought 160 acres there, southeast of a town called Ballard. He named it the Blind Frog Ranch because he discovered that the caverns underneath it were populated by, you guessed it, blind frogs. The goal is to mine the land for precious metals and possibly locate treasure left behind by Aztecs, Spaniards, Mexicans, and/or Mormons. Discovery, the TV channel, has aired shows about treasure hunting, gold prospecting, and searches for alien artifacts infused with spooky elements. But this program, Mystery at Blind Frog Ranch, combines all those elements as the drama plays out in eastern Utah. Well, I'll let you decide if you will watch the show or not. This information, as I said, came from the Salt Lake City Tribune. Right now, I have information to help you understand vision in frogs. Yes, really, vision in frogs. The information comes from www.nhm.uk. This is from the Natural History Museum in the South Kensington area of London. The headline reads, "The Secrets of Frog Vision Are Finally Being Revealed." The article was written by Josh Davis and was published in August of 2018. Through a series of expeditions up mountains and into rainforests, experts are figuring out exactly how frogs' eyesight works, using a wide range of technologies in the process. The first question they ask, what do we know about frog vision? Frogs are amphibians, animals that live between water and land. Their eyes have to deal with a lot compared with most of the animal kingdom, yet despite this incredible adaptability, surprisingly little research has delved into amphibian eyesight and how they perceive the world around them. Dr. Jeff Stryker, senior curator of amphibians and reptiles at the museum, and this is at the Natural History Museum in London, he says, unlike vertebrate groups such as mammals, birds, and reptiles, we actually know very little about amphibian vision. Almost everything we know is based upon a few studies looking at a limited number of frogs. This creates a problem because frogs are incredibly diverse in what they get up to, from those that spend all their lives underwater to some that pass their entire lives in the canopy, to others that live solely underground. Here's a quote too. There are almost 7,000 species of living frogs described so far. And they're not all the same, explains Jeff. This is Dr. Jeff Stryker from the Natural History Museum in London. He continues, in other groups where we see large numbers of species that have evolved over tens to hundreds of millions of years, we know that visual systems have changed a lot, often in relation to what they are doing. The next section is titled, Investigating Frog Eyesight in the Wild. Scientists from the museum, is the one in London, along with colleagues from the Smithsonian and from the University of Texas at Arlington, have set out on a series of expeditions to the four corners of the world to investigate how frog eyes have changed as the animals have adapted to different lifestyles. By looking at the amphibian family tree, the researchers were able to identify the most evolutionarily and ecologically distinctive groups. They then overlaid where these frogs live on a map of the world. This has taken the team to some of the world's most biodiverse places, stopping off in Australia, Africa, and the Pacific Northwest coast of the United States. The latest expedition took the researchers to the remote rainforests of French Guiana in South America. With near-pristine forests and a tropical ecosystem, it is an ideal place to find a wide range of frogs. The next section is titled Frogs in a Rainforest Laboratory. During their trips, the team has carried with them an impressive piece of equipment called a microspectrophotometer, built and run by Cornell University vision expert Ellis Lowe. This instrument, once again, I'll try to pronounce it, microspectrophotometer. This instrument is used to measure which wavelengths of light ranging from violet to infrared are absorbed by visual pigments in the rod and cone cells in the retinas of frogs. These two types of cells are known as photoreceptors, with the rods being responsible for vision in low light and the cones when light levels are higher. So what do frogs see? Researchers can determine how many visual pigments each frog has and the range of wavelengths each frog species might then be able to perceive. In turn, this can help build up a picture of what the amphibians can see. Carrying out this experiment in the field is easier said than done. It requires a complex kit to be kept at a stable room temperature and in complete darkness. Not easy to achieve at a remote research station in the humid jungle. It also needs fresh retinal cells. To do this, the scientists must first humanely euthanize the amphibian, and then carefully the eye is removed and dissected so as not to damage the tissue, and the retina is mounted on a microscopic slide. Crucially, and as an added hurdle, this all has to be carried out in the dark, so as not to activate the visual pigments in advance. Here's a quote. You are putting the retinal tissue on the slide, and then that is taken and put into a microscope, which is equipped with a very narrow beam of light that runs through all different wavelengths of light, explains Jeff. The beam is then fired at individual rod and cone cells in the retinal tissue, allowing the researchers to measure exactly which wavelengths are being absorbed and to determine which types of pigments are present in each type of photoreceptor cell. The next section is called Collecting Frogs to Save Them. Fresh retinal tissue is used for other aspects of the project, such as studying which genes are expressed in the eyes of each frog. This is done by analyzing the different RNA found in the eye tissue, an indication of which proteins are being made, and thus which genes are expressed in the eye. But RNA is not very stable. Here's a quote. RNA degrades very quickly after the animal stops making it, says Jeff. Even with fresh tissue, the researchers need to use a special buffer to prevent the molecules from falling apart as soon as the animal dies. This means that tissues from museum specimens are not feasible for looking at RNA. We're still a long way off from doing the same with museum collections as what we can do with the fresh tissue, explains Jeff. So that's why we've got this hybrid approach where we're using some fresh collections and then using both the Smithsonian and the Natural History Museum in London collections for the other bits, such as understanding how eye size has evolved among frogs. Fresh tissue collections are also of use for understanding the genetic diversity and other aspects of the natural history of frogs, especially poorly known tropical species. This is something that we actively do to give us a better chance of understanding these animals and ultimately to protect them. These quotes were from someone they referred to as Jeff in the article. This would be Dr. Jeff Stryker, who is the senior curator of amphibians and reptiles at the Natural History Museum in London. The article continues, though, and the headline reads, "Changing How We See Amphibians." The London Museum team, which also includes Dr. David Gower, who's head of the Vertebrates Division, and Dr. Kate Thomas, who's a postdoctoral researcher, this team is looking at many aspects involved in how frogs see, from the ways in which they perceive light to the genes expressed in the tissue, and even the characteristic of the lens and the shape of the eye. Here's a quote, "I think that the series of papers that come out of this project will recalibrate how we think about frog and amphibian vision," says Jeff. "But it's a case that we know so little that extra information will do that." The researchers have one final stop off later this year in Brazil before turning their full attention to examining what the data can tell them about how amphibians see the world around them. The next article I have is titled "The Secret of How Frogs See the World." The information came from psychologytoday.com. It was published on October 9th in 2020. It was written by Dr. Mary Bates. She is a PhD. "The Secret of How Frogs See the World." Frogs have the biggest eyes of any vertebrate in relation to their body size. It's clear to see that species like tree frogs have gigantic eyes, but the visual systems of most frogs have gone largely unstudied by scientists. An international interdisciplinary team of researchers is starting to change that. In the first study to come out of the collaboration, the team examined museum specimens representing all 55 frog families to test hypotheses about the evolution of frog eye size and its relationship to different aspects of their lifestyles. The results show that overall, frogs are investing a lot of energy in maintaining their eyes, and that vision is likely important to their survival and reproductive success. A person named Raina Bell, who's the assistant curator of herpetology at the California Academy of Sciences and one of the new paper's authors, says that although frogs were an early model for studying vision at the turn of the 20th century, the research was limited to a small number of easily accessible species. Here's a quote, "It was not reflective of the enormous diversity of frogs that we know exist today," she says. "Our understanding of vision in frogs has lagged behind such research in other vertebrates, such as fishes, birds, and mammals." There are more than 7,000 frog species living in a variety of different habitats and ecosystems. Some spend their entire lives underwater, others live in the treetops, and still others burrow underground. The first goal of Bell and her colleagues was to broaden out from those initial frog species whose vision had been characterized historically and document the diversity in eye size among frogs. To do this, her team depended primarily on specimens preserved in natural history collections around the world. They measured eye size in 220 frog species representing all 55 families. The study revealed that frogs have relatively large eyes for their body size, with certain species of tree frog coming out at the top. Bell, this is referring to Raina Bell, who's the curator of herpetology at the California Academy of Sciences. So the article continues, Bell says that relative eye size is an indication of how much an organism's energy budget is invested in eye tissue. Here's a quote, "Eyes are metabolically expensive to maintain, so if you have large eyes, that suggests you are relying pretty heavily on vision and investing energy in maintaining that eye tissue," she says. The team also tested whether the eye sizes were correlated with life history traits, like where frogs lived, or whether they are active at day or night. As is seen in other animals, there was a strong association between habitat type and eye size, with species that live underground or in murky water having reduced eyes. It's likely that in these light-deficient environments, animals are not relying as much on vision, and it's not worth it to invest in growing large eyes. Bell says this study is an important first step in understanding the diversity of eye size in frogs. Next, she and her colleagues are looking at the genetic underpinnings of this variation and characterizing photoreceptor sensitivity in different frogs. She's also interested in how frogs' visual systems change as they develop from aquatic tadpoles into adults who might live in a very different habitat. She ends with a quote and says, "It's interesting from an evolutionary perspective, but also from a behavioral perspective, in terms of understanding how frogs are sensing and interacting with their environment. We know that they have big eyes. We don't know specifically why, but we're working on it." And this is once again at the California Academy of Sciences. The next article goes to a different country. The information came from the BBC, www.bbc.com. The headline reads, "Brazilian island is overrun by invasion of blind toads." This article was written by Shreya Dasgupta. When Kururu toads reached the island of Fernando de Noronha, they became blind and deformed, and that has transformed their lifestyle. This was published in May of 2015. Before we start, I'll spell the name of those toads for you. It's Kururu, C-U-R-U-R-U, Kururu toads, and we're going to be talking about the island of Fernando de Noronha. The island of Fernando de Noronha, off the coast of Brazil, is teeming with deformed Kururu toads. They invaded the island several decades ago, and now almost half of them have malformed limbs, eyes, or mouth parts. Some toads lack hands or feet, while others have extra or missing fingers or misshapen ones. Others have abnormal jaws, mouths, or noses. About 20% of the deformed toads are also partially or completely blind. Some toads lack one or both of their eyes, and others have eyes with discolored irises or no iris at all. These deformities have profoundly changed how the toads behave. For instance, most toads use visual cues to find, chase, and catch their prey. But the blind toads on the island of Fernando de Noronha have adopted a different laid-back feeding strategy, according to a study published in the Journal of Zoology. Here's a quote. "Unlike the normal toads, the blind ones literally wait for the insects to walk to them before eating them." This is a quote from Luis Felipe Toledo, an amphibian biologist from the Campinas State University in Sao Paulo, Brazil. He continues and says, "Since the blind toads simply eat what's passing by, they are no longer selecting their prey," he adds. "That causes different body conditions." For example, Toledo found that the blind toads were lighter in weight than the normal toads and produced fewer eggs. So losing vision has had a cascading effect on the toads, from changing their predation tactics to ultimately affecting their fitness. Despite these deformities, the toads continue to thrive on the island. One reason is that the toads are an introduced species and do not have any natural predators or competitors on the island. Moreover, even though the deformed females produce fewer eggs, each one still pumps out thousands. And there's a quote, "That's enough to keep the population going," says Toledo. The tadpoles also suffer from various deformities. In a 2014 study, Toledo's team found that nearly 53% of the tadpoles they inspected had at least one anomaly. These malformed tadpoles could turn into either deformed toads or normal ones. No one knows for sure when or how the toads got there. Here's a quote. "There is a story that a priest, about 100 years ago, took some toads from mainland Brazil to the island to control insects on his crops," says Toledo. It's also unclear why they have since become deformed and blind. He quotes, "Everyone asks why the toads are like that," says Toledo, "and that is the one question we haven't answered yet." Toledo's team, together with researchers at the San Diego Zoo in California, are testing some ideas that might explain the large-scale malformation in the toads of Fernando de Noronha Island. For instance, they are investigating if a parasite, bacterium, or virus could be a potential culprit, and undertaking genetic studies to see if the toads are inbred. The team is also testing the island's water and soil for contaminants. Cane toads on Bermuda Island, for example, have limb deformities caused by petroleum hydrocarbons in the pond sediments. But the deformities are just the tip of the iceberg, according to Jamie Bacon of the Bermuda Zoological Society. She says, "We found endocrine disruption, suppressed immune function, and impaired reproduction as well, and not just in amphibians. So therefore, other species might be at risk." This is in Bermuda. Fernando de Noronha is a Brazilian National Marine Park and a UNESCO World Heritage Site. As a result, it is crucial to understand what is driving malformations in the Caruru toads, says Alan Pessier of the San Diego Zoo. He says these same factors may have the potential to impact or spill over into other wildlife species on the island, with their toad acting as an early warning system of problems in the environment, he says. Next, I have a few facts for you from Sarika Conwilker. She is an intern at the Jackson Hole Wildlife Film Festival back in 2014. Her article is titled, "I Wonder, Some Things You Didn't Know About Frog Eyes." She is the proud owner of two, by the way. First of all, she says frogs have two transparent eyelids, one on the bottom, one on the top, and a third, semi-transparent eyelid called the nictitating membrane. The nictitating membrane of the red-eye tree frog has a spectacular tiger stripe design, which camouflages the bright red color of the eyeball without compromising the frog's vision. Just like our eyelids, they serve to protect the eye underwater and to keep it moist on land. Now, there is a photo at this point in her article showing a close-up of the side of the head of a pale green frog. The frog's eye is bright reddish-orange, and it's covered halfway up by the semi-transparent nictitating membrane. The membrane is gray-colored, and it's very, very lacy in appearance. Next, I have something fun for you. It's called Tell Me a Story, The Puffed Up Frog, which is a French fable. This was adapted by Amy Friedman and published on January 9th of 2000 from the website kitsapsun.com. Here comes a fable. Once upon a time, a frog lived in a pond. Well, of course, he wasn't the only frog in the pond, and for a long time he lived among the others, croaking and dancing, playing and singing, leaping and laughing. But one day the frog looked at his family and friends and said, "I'm tired of your croaking and leaping and dancing. You look and sound ridiculous." The others were stunned into silence. They simply stared at him. "Look at you," the frog said. "Look at those patches on your skin. Look at your silly feet. And listen to you. All that croaking day and night." He plugged his ears and held his breath and puffed out his chest. "I'd much prefer to spend time with a creature with stature, someone big and strong and handsome and brave." The others croaked a little. "Oh, what do you mean?" they asked. "You're one of us." "Oh, no," the frog said, and off he leaped to see what he could find. For a while, he lived alone in a pond among the water lilies. He was waiting to meet someone new. And then, one day, just as he had imagined, a big ox wandered from his home and stopped at the frog's pond to have a drink. The frog looked up and saw the handsome ox and knew at once that he wanted to know this grand fellow. So he began to croak, and he leaped out of the water, up and down, this way and that, doing everything he could to attract the great ox's attention. Now, the ox had been wandering all day and was very thirsty, So he stood at the edge of the pond and drank and drank, never noticing the leaping, croaking frog. "Well, never mind," the frog said to himself. "I'll just wait until he's finished drinking, then he'll talk to me." He swam up close to the ox's face and waited, croaking now and then, hoping the ox would soon notice him. At last, the ox finished drinking his fill, but when he did, he noticed the water lilies. "How beautiful," the ox